and we are going to continue our coverage of the Sean Bell verdict on today's Reporters Roundtable. We'll also take a look at the latest from Zimbabwe, and Republican nominee John McCain is on the trail to woo black folks. For more on this week's news, we have radio host Cynthia Pryor Hardy. Her talk show, On Point with Cynthia, airs from Columbia, South Carolina. Also, Cheryl McCarthy, she's a columnist for Newsday, a New York newspaper. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we just heard from NPR's Robert Smith in New York. Cheryl McCarthy, you're with Newsday. What do you feel the mood of the city is right now?
Well, you know, I thought that while it's a very sad day, I thought that the families, the Sean Bell families' response to the verdict, although this must have been very painful for them, very disappointing for them, the fact that they walked past the cameras, did not take this opportunity to make any kind of angry statement or try to fire up the crowd, this went right past the reporters and went out to Sean Bell's gravesite. And it was a very eloquent statement about their feeling about this verdict and about what happened to Sean Bell.
Well, let's listen to Leroy Gadsden of the New York State NAACP. He spoke outside of the courthouse after the verdict was announced.
This case was not about justice. This case is about the police officer having the right to act above the law. If the law was in effect here, if the judge had followed the law, truly, these officers would have been found guilty.
Cynthia, do you get a sense that protests from the NAACP or from other sources will cause a ripple effect, not just in New York, but that this case would be talked about in other parts of the country?
Thank you. I am hopeful that that will be the case, but I'm more hopeful that the leadership will come from within the community. It's very sad because people had expected a different verdict today. What's happening across the country in terms of police brutality is well documented, and I think people feel as if I see it, why don't you? And what happens is resentment breeds within our communities when it appears that there's an all-out assault on certain races or genders in our society, and certainly black men do often get the short end of the stick. I hear the argument to the contrary all the time, but then something like this with Sean Bell occurs, and it makes the point. The correspondent a few minutes ago pointed to the fact that even the mayor, right after this occurred, indicated that it appeared to be excessive force and that it seemed unacceptable and inexplicable. But today, those seem like empty words, certainly to the family and to people across the country paying attention to this case.
I also want to play a clip from a spokesperson, Patrick Lynch, of the New York City Patrolman Benevolent Association.
This sends a message to New York City police officers that when you were in that position, when you were in front of a courthouse, when you are in front of that court bench, that you will get fairness. And that is what New York City police officers need each and every day. Every time a police officer goes on the street, there is never a script. We have to deal with circumstances as they come. This was a tragedy with a death. It's a tragedy for all police officers that have to live with the difficult job we do. But nonetheless, we're grateful for this outcome.
So, again, NPR's Robert Smith brought up the fact that it is a different environment in New York now compared to, say, the Giuliani administration. Nonetheless, Cheryl, this must be a moment when there is an increase in tension between the New York City police and some of the communities of color. How do you see things playing out, whether it's mediation from the mayor or mediation of the situation by the police officers?
Well, you know, and this goes back to something that Robert said, you know, quoting Judge Cooperman as saying, you know, carelessness is not a crime. And when you have cases like this, and we've seen them before, the cops will say, you know, well, we were, you know, we have to act on the spur of the moment and we were feared for our life. But, you know, carelessness is a crime when you're a cop carrying a gun, and you start shooting at people. You start firing, you know, 30 and 40, and people start dying and get seriously injured. And, you know, and the sad thing is that we continue to have these, I think every case has to be, you know, judged on its own particular set of facts. But when you continue having these situations where you have black men who are found not to be doing anything illegal, not to have a weapon, and the cops fear them, and fear their lives are in danger, generally, I think, because they are black men, and cops, you have cops who fear black men and just suddenly think they're in danger because they see black men. And these people who are not doing anything illegal wind up dead. That is a serious problem, you know, and, you know, there's going to be repercussions. I mean, you're going to almost definitely have some kind of civil judgment. The city, the taxpayers are going to wind up paying millions of dollars probably to the Sean Bell family and to the his two friends who were injured. And that's probably appropriate. But yes.
Let me get Cynthia in here. Are there any echoes of this case in something that might have happened in South Carolina or your region?
Oh, absolutely. In the last few weeks, the South Carolina Department of Public Safety has been all over the media. All these tapes have been released. Their car cams have recorded mistreatment of African Americans, of women. You've seen them using their cars to run over suspects in an effort to stop them. And so here in our state, the NAACP and the South Carolina Legislative Black Caucus they've worked together with the governor of the state to try to bring about some resolution to some of the things that are occurring there. But I think what it points to is police brutality and excessive force misconduct all over the United States.
I'm going to have to jump in, and I want both of you to hang tight with us for a few minutes. We are going to return with our reporters' roundtable after a break. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. We're continuing our conversation on our reporters' roundtable. We have radio host Cynthia Pryor Hardy. Her show, On Point with Cynthia, airs from Columbia, South Carolina, plus Newsday columnist Cheryl McCarthy. Hi, folks, and we're going to just jump right back into it with a different topic, international news. Yesterday, the U.S. officially got involved with the Zimbabwe election situation. Voting took place over a month ago, but President Robert Mugabe's government never released the votes and the results of the votes. And now the U.S. is declaring that opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai won the presidency. Now, some say the U.S. didn't do enough when the election problems first started. And Cynthia, when it comes to situations like this, where there have been historic tensions between Zimbabwe and the U.S., should the U.S. get involved? And if so, how?
Well, you know, I think certainly the United States, as other powerful nations, have a responsibility to the rest of the world when they think they see injustices, particularly injustices that relate to human injustices. We see so much going on there in terms of so many people hungry, so many people homeless, you know, so many people being being inflicted actually themselves by all of the confusion that's going on there. However, when I talk to my friends from that region, they say that the United States should not. They indicate that while the United States may feel as if it's Big Brother coming to the rescue, Western influence is perhaps the biggest problem that countries like Zimbabwe face.
Cheryl, when you are looking at this situation, we're hearing now about violence. Zimbabwe police have raided the headquarters of the opposition and of independent election observers. They're taking away voting materials. Reportedly, police have also arrested and beaten hundreds of people. Now, in addition to that, China sent a shipment of weapons to Zimbabwe, but for nearly a week, the ship was detained in different ports in Africa. So it appears the ship's on its way back to China due to this boycott. When you look at the violence on the ground, but the fact that arms were not able to reach the country, is that at least the glass half full?
Well, I think it's certainly appropriate for the, I don't know if it's half full, half empty. I think it's a very bad situation, and that Mr. Mugabe, who's headed the country for 28 years, cannot step aside and let somebody else run it for a change. But I do think it's appropriate for the United States certainly to express its deep dissatisfaction, its criticism of what of Mr. President Mugabe's refusal to release the results of the election, what his party is doing against the opposition party. And I think it would be appropriate, you know, certainly to have some kind of boycott to say that this denial of human rights is really something that we don't want to support and that we are really strongly against.
I'm going to move on to yet another topic because it's all fast-paced on this Friday. Cynthia, Republican nominee John McCain is on a week-long tour, often being called the poverty tour. He's taking time to reach out to black voters. In Selma, he praised U.S. Representative John Lewis, who suffered serious injuries during the civil rights movement on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. Do you think this is going to pan out for McCain in terms of having reached to non-traditional Republican voters? Let's just put it that way.
Well, one thing's for certain. McCain's got a lot of time to fill. And I don't know that it's not a good use of time for him to go into African-American communities and to hear what people are thinking and what people are feeling. I can't imagine people not appreciating that, especially if he goes to it with a degree of sincerity. I think people want to be reached out to. You know, and when it comes to it, you know, people might say, well, you know, McCain's in the African-American communities, and you wouldn't normally find him there. Well, when it comes down to it, the candidates that are coming through our communities, whether it's Clinton or Obama, we normally don't see them either. You know, so I think it's not a bad thing, you know, for him to reach out to African-American people and to reach out to people and hear what they're thinking and feeling.
Cheryl, yesterday McCain toured the Ninth Ward in New Orleans, criticizing the Bush administration about its slow response after Katrina. He called that slow reaction terrible and disgraceful. Now, Bush and McCain have had a long, tense history at points. They were once competitors for the presidential nomination. Do you think now that with McCain going into the election, being the candidate, getting the president's endorsement, they're going to put those issues behind them and work as a team, maybe even the current president going out on the stump for McCain?
Oh, I definitely do, you know, because, you know, the Republicans want to win again. And they're going to have to pull together in this election. So I do think that they're going to put some of that behind them, and you're going to see Bush out there for McCain. But you're just following up on what Cynthia said. I think it is, you know, McCain has a terrible record, both with the ACLU, with the NAACP, and on civil rights issues. It's amusing to see him down there buying quilts from the black women in G's Bend and going to Selma, where I gather most of the people who turned out were white. And it's probably not going to pan out in terms of votes, but from black people. But it's good that he's doing that, that he is getting exposed at this late date to what black communities and poor communities, what their concerns are, because, you know, there's a 50-50 chance that he may be our president. And so it's very important for him to be exposed to that.
All right. Well, Cheryl and Cynthia, we got to wrap it up here. Thanks so much.
Thank you, too.
Thank you.
Cheryl McCarthy is a columnist for Newsday. She joined us from our studios in New York City. And Cynthia Pryor Hardy is the host of the radio talk show On Point with Cynthia. Today, we wrap up our month-long housing series with a look at something that's been on our minds a lot. We're talking about the mortgage crisis and how it's affecting our friends, families, country, and ourselves. According to the Federal Reserve, 1 in 7 American homeowners owes more on their house than it's worth. That puts millions of people at risk of foreclosure. And there are a lot of opinions as to why this is happening. In just a few minutes, we'll hear from a California real estate and lending expert, but first, a national perspective on the foreclosure crisis. Thomas Martin is president of America's Watchdog, a national housing consumer advocacy group. Thomas, welcome.
Thank you so much.
So what exactly does it mean to have your home foreclosed on?
Well, in a nutshell, it means you haven't been making your mortgage payments. You're upside down as far as payments, and the bank's taking the property back. And it's all, you know, based on the contract you signed in the deed or the note.
How far behind in payments do you have to be before they really go after you on a foreclosure basis?
It depends on the loan servicer or the lender itself, but in subprimes it could be as low as 3 months and they start foreclosure. It mainstream banks, because of politics, and they're trying to hide the truth from the shareholders, it may be 6 to 8 months or even more.
Now, do you think African Americans and Latinos are disproportionately affected by this whole mortgage shakeout?
Well, everyone was affected. I mean, all genders, all races, all ages, but blacks and Spanish speakers, absolutely yes. One being the blacks, I think, you know, they were in certain city neighborhoods frequently, and they had a lot of sudden equity or instant equity in their homes. And so people just took advantage. The industry targeted them. I mean, we've seen case after case where people are receiving letters saying get $10,000 or $15,000, no credit checks, no appraisal, no nothing. They bit, not realizing that the loan, when I reviewed the papers, cost them $30,000 or $40,000.
Tom, when you talk with people, and you've talked with thousands of homeowners across the country, what are they saying about both how they got into this mess and are they hopeful of getting out, or are most of them fatalistic?
I think pretty fatalistic at this point. I think the clock's hit 12 and people are realizing I'm in deep trouble and I need to get out. And what terrifies us is that our National Mortgage Complaint Center has projected that by this time next year, one in four U.S. homeowners will own more in their house than it's worth. And what mortifies us is the fact that they walk. We'd be worried about a lot more than just a recession right now.
Do you think there's going to be a government bailout of not of institutions as we've seen already, but of individual homeowners?
I was in Katrina, and that was 80,000 houses. They did a horrible job on that, so we're terrified the fact that the government will come in too late in the game to stop any foreclosures, spend a bunch of money, and really not get the desired result. The issue is so complex. The whole spectrum of buyers are out there. People have put nothing down, home flippers, et cetera. We're not exactly sure how the government does a bailout.
We are used to hearing about people who have lower priced homes and overextended themselves and maybe had subprime mortgages. But now you're seeing a trend of some people who have fairly pricey homes getting into trouble. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, we think it was an embellishment. The numbers that the industry is releasing right now, we think are dramatically lower than what they actually are. I think I've seen numbers of 5,000 or 7,000. If you really throw in the high-rise...
We're talking about homes worth at least $1 million.
Oh, yeah. If you throw in the high-rise condos in Miami-Dade, throughout the country, L.A., with these million-dollar-plus houses, we're probably looking at 25,000 to 35,000 foreclosures just within the next 12 months. So six times the numbers I've seen, five or six times.
Where are the hot spots? You mentioned Miami's condo overbuilding. Where else are there real trouble spots?
Southern California is going to detonate in the next 12 months, and that's going to be the big problem for the country because the price thresholds of houses are so high in Southern California or Northern California that, it's like four houses in Ohio. And if they go, we think we'll start seeing bank failures.
Well, I'm in Southern California, and every time I walk down my street, I see some other place for sale. It's definitely something that you can literally see on the streets. So if you're someone who's not in foreclosure but who knows that things are really tightening up, what advice would you have for that person?
Well, we get probably 15 to 30 phone calls a day on that one, and we just tell people consult an attorney. Find out what your best legal avenues are because we are not attorneys, but certainly we're trying to tell people the foreclosure is still going to happen. So you may have to go bankrupt if that's the appropriate avenue. A short sale, which means to sell the property before you even get for it and give it to the bank and hopefully walk away, or even, in fact, go deed in lieu, which just means you walk into the bank, put the keys on the counter, and just walk away.
Thomas, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thomas Martin is president of America's Watchdog, a national housing consumer advocacy group. And let's focus now on a state with one of the biggest foreclosure problems in the country. We're talking California. Last month, one in every 200 California households received a foreclosure notice. That is 2.5 times the national average. For a closer look at how you can keep a hold of your home, we've got Nancy Harris. She's been in the real estate and lending industry for more than 20 years, and she owns Harnan Financial Group in Los Angeles. The company helps people locate, finance, and buy property. Welcome.
Good morning.
So we just heard a little bit about bankruptcy. Is that really an option for people?
Bankruptcy is an option for certain people depending on their specific situation. The trouble is that with real estate and just individuals in general, every scenario is specific and subjective. So what may be good bankruptcy for one person, that may be a good option. For others, it may not.
Give us a story. You've dealt with so many different people, but give us a story of a client who was facing foreclosure, but you managed to save him or her. Just generalities about it.
Yes, this is just funny. This just happened just a week or so ago. A client called me and wasn't really sure how bad their situation was. So luckily, I was able to get the paperwork and any public records that were filed against the property. And to my horror, and this is the truth, the day that I looked at the paperwork, their house was going to be sold on the courthouse steps in about an hour from when I was looking at the paperwork. So what I did was call the client, apprise them of what was going on, and did they realize they were literally about to lose their house, was going to be sold from under them in about a half hour. I called the trustee company who was in charge of the sale, spoke with them, got them in touch with the client, and long story short, they were able to wire some money in time to prevent that sale from going on the steps of the courthouse. But, I mean, that's an extreme case, but this is the stuff we're looking at.
Do you think people procrastinate because they just can't face talking to anyone, including people at the bank, about it, or they're ashamed?
That's a huge part of it. People stick their heads in the sand, don't open the mail, because the banks and lenders go through a lot before they actually take your property. They are trying to communicate with you. And so a lot of it is, again, shame, embarrassment, and people just don't want to deal with it.
You've been in the industry for 20 years. How have things changed, and do these things go through cycles?
Absolutely, and that's some things that people have to remember. This is all cyclical. Now, every cycle takes a different type of personality, and this cycle is taking yet a different personality and a pretty painful one. But you always have ups and downs in real estate, and that's what people have to realize. Real estate basically is a long-term investment. It is not a short-term, use your house as an ATM investment. It's a long-term investment. When you go against those principles, you have to understand what you're getting into. You run the risk of getting in markets where your investment goes down, just like the stock market. Your investment goes down. What can you do?
Now, how many of your clients would you say have had subprime loans? How big of it is a problem is it for people who you've dealt with?
Well, I would probably say of my portfolio, anywhere from 25 to 30% of my portfolio over the last, I would say, 5 years was in subprime loans. And, you know, this is my personal opinion, but it the loan itself is not the problem. It's the understanding that the client had of what they were getting themselves into. For instance, my clients, I told them, I said, you know, you're going to be paying this now, but in the change, you're going to be paying this. Can you afford it?
You also sell real estate. Some people are saying now is the perfect time to buy, or 6 months later, or this, that, or the other. If you think that you're in a position to buy, what should you do, and is it a good time?
If you're in a position to buy, meaning that you have some money saved up, you have good credit, and you can literally afford, literally, dollar-wise, to purchase a piece of property, it is a fabulous time to buy. Unfortunately, you know, we do have a lot of foreclosures. It's a lot of product on the market, which enables ones that are qualified and prepared to take the step. They have a vast array of product available to them.
What about auctions? Are they a good idea for people who may not be experts to really look into?
With the auction scenario, you do need to do your homework. You need to know what you're getting into. You have to walk in with money that you're willing to spend, and you have to do your due diligence on the properties because you have to know where your limit is and what you're willing to pay to get that property.
All right. Well, Nancy, thank you.
You're welcome.
Nancy Harris owns Harnan Financial Group in Los Angeles. The group helps people locate, finance, and buy property. She also blogs about financial issues at harnanloans.com. And she was with me at our NPR West studios. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Malcolm Shabazz was just 12 years old when he lit a fire that put him on the wrong side of history. His grandmother was Betty Shabazz, the widow of Malcolm X. She died when the young Malcolm Shabazz burned her home down in 1997. Malcolm Shabazz is now 23 years old. He's been out of prison for a little over a year, and he's decided to tell his side of the story, how his rough childhood spent in and out of mental institutions put him in the mindset to start that fire. Writer Aaliyah King has been in close contact with Shabazz since he was in jail. She stitched their conversations into a three-part series for the New Urban News website, newsone.com. The first installment goes live on the site today. And Aaliyah joins me now along with News One editor-in-chief Smokey Fontaine. Aaliyah, Smokey,
hi,
welcome.
Hi, how are you? Thank
you. How are you?
I'm doing great. So, Aaliyah, how did you first get involved with Malcolm Shabazz?
The story was actually born out of a conversation I had with Smokey. I've been writing for him for over 10 years through different publications. And we were talking about doing some long-form research pieces. And one thing that both intrigued us was the story of Malcolm Shabazz. And we had no idea where he could possibly be at that time when we were having this conversation. We didn't know if he was living in Harlem where he had some roots or if he was in prison or what had become of him. So it began with that conversation in Smokey's office and then me sitting in front of my computer trying to figure out where this young man was.
Aaliyah, once you found him, there was no guarantee that he would be willing to talk, but obviously he did. Why do you think he chose to?
That's a really good question, and I have to tell you that right now I'm still not sure, and I still wonder about that every time I talk to him. I put his name in a prison inmate locator just on a whim for New York State, and it came up. Actually, several Malcolm Shabazzes came up, which I thought was interesting, but only one that matched the right birth date. I wrote him a letter asking him if I could meet him, and he wrote me back and said, no, you can't. I want to know who you are, I want to know what you've written, and I want to know why you want to talk to me before I agree to that. So that started about a 2 or 3 month process of me sending him stories that I'd written, some he liked, some he didn't like. And at one point he finally decided, I'd like you to come up to Attica, which is where he was in prison, and visit me.
What did you find out about how his childhood was spent?
Even before I went to Attica, the research that I found was very troubling. I knew that his mother had suffered from a lot of different illnesses, including substance abuse and possibly some mental problems. I knew he had been shuttled back and forth through Malcolm X's 6 daughters and with his grandmother, whom he was very close to. So I knew there had not been a lot of stability there. So I knew that his life had not been an easy one.
Smokey, since you came up with the idea of pursuing this story, I want to also mention another case. Earlier this year, we had a man on the program named Khalil Islam. He went to prison for more than 2 decades for murdering Malcolm X, and he maintains his innocence. In reading your piece about Malcolm Shabazz's story, I can't help but get this sense of tragedy that seems to follow the family. Why is this family and their story, including Malcolm's story, important to us still?
Well, I think clearly it starts with the legacy of Malcolm's grandfather, Malcolm X. And you know, in my mind, he still stands as, you know, one of the most, if not the most important kind of African-American leader that this country or even the world has ever seen. And, you know, I was just so fascinated by, you know, what he left behind. He had 6 daughters, so of course he had no sons. And, you know, even when I was much younger and heard about the tragedy around the death of Betty Shabazz, I was fascinated by what this boy was going through. You know, we think about, you know, the children of either celebrities or the children of politicians, but it seemed that he was in such a peculiar situation because he was the only, you know, he was the only boy and a grandson. His name was Malcolm, and then when he was 10 years old, this awful thing kind of happened to him. And I was always struck by so much of what I felt was the prevailing kind of negative energy towards him, that it seemed almost immediately through the kind of media coverage of the fire that this boy was blamed for being out of control and psychotic. It was even mentioned in the press around the time, and that he was you know, treated very poorly as a juvenile. And as he grew up, and I knew he was in and out of jail, in and out of juvenile institutions, in and out of group homes, I was fixated in my mind just what he would look like. What would the 20-something-year-old, you know, grandson of Malcolm X look like? And my initial question in my mind was, does he look like his grandfather? And that's the question, you know, Lee and I kind of threw around to each other. And I think, you know, the legacy is so kind of almost frightening, because now he's 23 years old, and the first, you know, his life so far has almost mirrored his grandfather's life, to the point where, you know, they came from disadvantaged and troubled homes and spent a lot of their formative years incarcerated. And the similarities to what that means, you know, 40 years later to have such a similar experience was something that, you know, we're evolving, or Leah's evolving in her relationship with Malcolm over time.
Well, you know, you can see Malcolm Shabazz on the cover of Giant magazine. The full article will be published on your site, newsone.com. Getting back to you, Aaliyah, who is this man today? What kind of vibe did he give you when you walked in to meet him? Is he forgiving of himself, or does he still blame himself?
I asked him that question directly, not when he was in prison, but afterward. We met several times. And I point blank asked him, have you made your peace with what happened to your grandmother? And he said, with very clear eyes and a very strong demeanor, he said, yes, I have forgiven myself. It was an accident. I did not mean to hurt my grandmother. And I know that for a fact. And he doesn't always speak in those kind of absolutes. But I remember that standing out to me, that this young man who was very young was very clear on that, that he definitely has forgiven himself, although other people have not.
When you say other people have not, does that include his family?
Yes, unfortunately. I do think that there are some members of his family who have not been able to make their peace with what happened. I mean, Betty Shabazz and Malcolm X had six daughters, and they are Malcolm's aunts. And it has to be... it's a tragedy on top of a tragedy. Not only, you know, putting yourself in the aunt's position for a minute, not only did you lose your mother, but it's your nephew who is responsible for this tragedy. So I can imagine that it's very difficult. And I do think there are some of his aunts who have not yet forgiven him.
Smokey, as you continue this new venture, do you plan on doing more stories like this that pull out hidden or unexpected members of the Black community?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's overdue for us to have an opportunity, and some of your work has really spoken to this, that there are so many stories that are African-American stories but are American stories, and so many figures and identities that I think, you know, are constantly evolving, and to, you know, to find someone that can really teach us a lot about who we are as a culture and who we are as an American society, and in so many angles. I mean, there's the angle of being an incarcerated African-American man and how the kind of penal system has served him or not. You know, the angle of what it means to come from a home that, you know, was very troubled and was you know, become a victim of kind of, you know, all the things that Leah mentioned, alcoholism and different abuse and mental illness, but also how we treat our own. You know, I mean, the idea to have Malcolm, the grandson, celebrate his father's legacy by dressing up like him was one that I knew would stir up a lot of emotion. You know, and Aaliyah called me on the day of the photo shoot in tears, essentially, when she saw the young Malcolm, you know, put on the blazer and the skinny tie and the fedora, and suddenly it felt like the spirit of his grandfather was in that room. And when we got the photographs back, just even in my magazine office, even some of my younger staff were immediately struck by that image, and some of them started kind of yelling at the computer screen, like, "Oh, he shouldn't do that," and, you know, that's he's kind of disgracing his grandfather's image. And in conversation, it seemed that there was so much, negative energy towards this boy, and he was only a boy, and I feel that's kind of unfair. And what he has said in our article is that if you understood who I am and my story, I think you'd feel about me in a different way.
Well, Smokey, Aaliyah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaliyah King is a contributing writer for the online magazine NewsOne.com. Smokey Fontaine is NewsOne's editor-in-chief. And the first installment of Aaliyah's three-part series on Malcolm Shabazz post on the site today. Aaliyah and Smokey both join me from our NPR studios in New York. Wesley Snipes gets 3 years in the slammer on tax evasion. Talk TV star Jones calls it quits on her marriage less than 4 years after walking down the aisle. But Beyonce and Jay-Z are just getting started after tying the knot in a hush-hush ceremony. Joining me now for the Hollywood Rundown is Allison Samuels, a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine. Always great to have you here.
Hi.
So a U.S. district judge hit actor Wesley Snipes with a three-year prison sentence for skipping out on taxes. Tell us a little bit more about what kind of money we're talking about, and do you think the sentence is extreme?
Well, Wesley has had financial problems for a while now. I think people, a lot of people sort of didn't realize that. He had a lot of foreclosures on his home in Florida. He lost, his cars were repossessed, and this has been going on for probably the last 10 years. So he owed almost $41 million, $14 million that they want right now, even though he's going to prison. So I think a lot of people might have been surprised by the 3 years, but I'm not really surprised by it, because if you look at like Ronald Isley, he's in jail now for tax evasion. They take that very seriously. And Wesley's whole attitude was, I shouldn't have to pay taxes. And I don't think anybody gets away with that. And also, too, Wesley has had, it's hard to sort of explain his karma in Hollywood. About 3 years ago, the LA Times did a big story asking what had happened to his career. Because Wesley was really supposed to be Denzel number two. He was supposed to be this huge star. And one big case was a case against Dolores Robinson, his manager, Holly Robinson, Pete's mother, where he wouldn't pay her percentage of a manager's fee. And I think from that point on, he sort of got a lot of ill will from Hollywood, and his career sort of gone down as a result of that. And it was interesting to see Denzel Washington and Woody Harrelson write letters asking the judge for leniency.
Why do you think that was the case?
Well, the interesting part is if you read Woody Harrelson's, he basically talked about how when he was on Wildcats was with Wesley, the movie, he and Goldie Hawn were the only two white people on the shoot, and that was the first time he had experienced racism. So it actually didn't really help Wesley, his letter. With Denzel, he called Wesley a mighty oak, which I think sort of translated into, I don't know why I'm writing this letter, but I want to help this guy because I feel bad for him. I think people have seen him on this decline for a while, and, you know, I think a lot of people saw this coming. So I feel sorry for him, but, you know, we all have to pay taxes. So I don't know. He couldn't avoid that.
There are other celebrities who are on these various roles, state and national, owing millions of dollars in taxes, including O.J. Simpson. Mm-hmm. Why is this case so special?
Well, I think because the amount of money, a huge amount of money, and because, you know, Wesley, like I said, was supposed to be this huge star, and he's been so defiant with it. I mean, like, I don't owe this money, and he's also called it racist, which I think always gets the media and the public sort of roused up. But I'm like, Wesley, you know, no one gets away with not paying their taxes, and particularly, this is a guy who used to be a black Muslim, you know, selling, you know, bean pies on the street in Harlem. So to watch him go from that to this is just sort of very interesting. I think people are fascinated at the decline of anyone's career.
Death and taxes. Mm-hmm. Now, there's also matrimony. Mm-hmm. We're going to move into that territory with Star Jones and Beyonce. Star Jones, former co-host of the TV hit The View, is headed for divorce. Mm-hmm. She married banker Al Reynolds. There were a lot of rumors floating around that he is gay. They never said anything about that specifically, but said that they went into the marriage with their eyes open, essentially. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the link between her wedding and the end of her career on The View, just for starters?
Well, I think that wedding really caused her to sort of to be fired from The View. The way that she talked about it every single day, the way that she sort of got sponsors to help her pay for some of the sort of freebies in her wedding, I think turned so many people off, viewers, the other co-stars. I think ABC decided, you know what, enough is enough. And I think it's very sad to see less than, you know, 4 years later, that thing that sort of cost her career, the most visible job, the most, you know, very high paying job, probably one of the best jobs on TV, is now come to an end. And I think a lot of people saw it coming. I don't think she saw it coming, but I think it is really sad because she was so desperate, I think, to get married. And, you know, you wanted to be happy for her, but you also saw this eventual end. So, you know, it's sad to sort of see it.
She's had two other TV shows canceled. Has lost a huge amount of weight, you know, is a very, in some ways, not just to the eye, but in terms of her career, is a very different woman than she was when she was on The View. Mm-hmm. What do you make of her marriage?
Well, I mean, again, I thought she was very desperate. She was over 40. And, you know, a lot of people go through that, particularly African-American women over 40. You want to get married. And, I think I understood
some
that.
Some people want to get married.
Some people want to get married. But, I mean, I definitely see that that is the American dream, quote unquote. So you fall into that sort of, oh, I have to do this to sort of be acceptable. But I think she just got carried away with it. And the unfortunate part is that after they got married, he quit his job. So she was the only one working. And now no one's working. So I think that just sort of got to the point of, okay, I can't handle this. Someone has to have a job. And why, she had so many people warn her about this, so many friends of hers, so many people outside of Hollywood that sort of tried to talk to her about it, that she's a smart lady. I was really surprised that she didn't sort of get out of this before it turned into something so ugly, because he's hired a major divorce lawyer, and I think it's going to be probably an ugly divorce.
Is this sort of Terry McMillan-ish, both in its overtures of sexuality, money,
I think
who
so.
Knew what?
I think it's exactly like that. And that's the sad part, that, you know, she had that, you know, example out there and still didn't sort of take a minute to sort of say, okay, what am I doing? But I mean, Terry is, you know, Terry, I feel bad for her as well.
Just quickly, Jayonce. Tied the knot.
Right.
Now been proven.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think they're going to do?
I think they're going to do great because they have not made this a public spectacle. I mean, they didn't sell pictures. They have not talked about the relationship basically in the 6 years they've been together. They made it a point to keep their relationship out of the public eye. And I think, you know, you have to give them credit for that because they could have easily sold pictures for $1 million to whomever. But they decided, you know what? Our relationship is sacred. We're not going to put it out there for you to sort of, you know, pick over. And I think because of that, they probably will hang in there.
Will it add juice to both of their careers, sort of the way Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie have had, you know, double trouble or, you know, double the superpower?
It depends. I think that because, A, they're African-American, they're not going to get that same type of coverage. But I do think that it's already helped Jay-Z's career. I think mainstream America know, you know, they have way more interest in him than they would if he were just Jay-Z, the rapper. But I think if they keep it quiet like they have, you know, it'll probably stay about the same.
Allison, always great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Allison Samuels is a national correspondent for Newsweek magazine, and she joined me here at our NPR West studios.